attitude. We are going to energise the country.
Stop Brexit.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Seamus, I'm not sure this is a great idea.
Order.
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by the current chair of the Mongolian British Chamber of Commerce and the former Labour MP for the seats of Selby from 1997 to 2010 and Keighley from 2017 to 2019. John Grogan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much indeed.
So the first question that I'd like to ask is the recent general election. There seemed to be quite a shock at the scale of the defeat for the Labour Party for a lot of people involved. How did you feel at the time of the result?
Well, I think I could see it coming for the days beforehand. I remember my agent on the day was looking on Twitter and said, "Oh, there's going to be a youthquake, John, and we're going to win this easy." But I doubted that, having knocked on hundreds of doors. I think based on the experience of 2017, many party supporters thought, well, it will come back to us. And in essence, the opinion polls hardly changed, at least the gap hardly changed in the whole course of the election, really. So I lived in hope right the way through to the count. And indeed, the swing in Keighley was not too bad in the general scheme of things. It was just over 2%. So I was only defending a majority of 246 and I lost by something over 2,000. So, disappointed, but not unduly surprised, I think.
Now, one of the results from the general election loss is, of course, Jeremy Corbyn stepping down as leader of the Labour Party and the Labour leadership contest. I just wondered if you could tell the listeners who you're supporting in the Labour leadership and why.
Yeah, very, very soon after the election, one of my greatest friends in politics, who's still an MP, Judith Cummings, is the MP in Bradford South, rang me up and said, are you going to support Keir Starmer? And I said, give me a couple of hours and I'll ring you back. And I thought about it for a couple of hours and rang her back. And the two of us have been organising Yorkshire for the Keir Starmer campaign ever since, really. And I think he's the standout candidate. I think he's grown as the campaign has gone on. I saw him in York last week and he was a level above what he'd been a month ago when I saw him in Leeds. I think he'd be good at running a team. Having done a big job as the director of prosecutions in the past, I think he'll be good at keeping people together. And I think he'll move us a little bit back into the political mainstream, if you like. And I think he'll also be good at holding the Conservatives to account in Parliament and making sure his team does. It's a long, long haul back. If you look at the latest opinion polls, Tories on nearly 50%, I think, and you know we're on about 30%, so even worse than the election. So it's had a long, long haul back. But I just think in 4 years' time, nearly 5 years' time, when we have another election, the days of sort of right-wing populists, if you like President Trump and Boris Johnson to some extent, they may be gone, and someone of a more serious stature like Keir, maybe that will be his time. So we'll see. But I think he's going to win. I think he's going to win now.
How do you think he will deal with the upcoming local elections? I mean, there's sort of a bit of an uncertainty as to whether they'll take place, obviously, with the coronavirus that's going around at the moment. I wonder, how do you think he would tackle them?
Well, he'll have to be quick off the mark, won't he? And the virus is obviously hanging over all politics at the moment. And I was talking with some friends this morning, you know, will the even the there's meant to be a conference where the result is announced in early April in London. And that would obviously be a platform for him to begin to campaign in the local elections. But I would doubt whether that event is likely to happen, really, in 3 or so weeks' time. And so a lot of it will have to be done through television and so on. I think it must be a 50-50 call whether those elections take place in May. I mean, the obvious precedent, it was foot and mouth, which I think put back the elections at least a month when that was happening under the Tony Blair government. I suppose if they are postponed, that gives him a little bit more time, because what he won't want is a bad result to start his leadership off. So he'll really have to hit the ground running and make one or two big announcements, I think, in those first few weeks to draw attention, because people are not going to be interested in the Labour Party really for some time, is the honest to goodness truth. And just fighting for attention, even as the major opposition party, is going to be a challenge for him. But I think one thing he can do is create a new team, and I think that's something that will get attention and will, if it's a broad-based team, bring back a few people maybe who've talents have not been used in recent years, but also bringing on some new people. I think that might just indicate to the population that the Labour Party is under new management, and I think that would give us a boost in the opinion polls in itself.
Now, you mentioned the party drawing attention to itself, but of course, something that has been drawing a lot of attention to itself recently has been the budget. What have your thoughts been on that?
Well, obviously a remarkable turnaround in politics when you have the former Prime Minister Theresa May gently hinting, well, more than gently, to a party about fiscal responsibility and so on. So I'm glad to see that the argument about borrowing to invest has now been won. I mean, that could have been done at any time in the last 10 years, but that now has become part of the political consensus, and that's good. I don't believe that it's the end of austerity myself, in the sense that all the local government services, whether that be libraries or refuse or to some extent schools as well and so on, there's no big boosts in expenditure in many of those services. And so as someone who represented a Yorkshire Northern seat, it's good that we're going to have more investment in the north. I'm pleased to see some movement on devolution as well. But in the end, I think if we're really going to transform the north, we're going to have to transfer a lot more power to the north and devolve it rather than make decisions in Whitehall. So, for example, it's good to have 25 million in the town I represented, Keighley, and the neighbouring town of Shipley. But really, can't the decision on how to spend that be made entirely locally? Why does it have to be referred back to Whitehall? And it's a turnaround in politics. But as far as day-to-day expenditure on many of the services that people rely on, there was disappointingly little change.
Now, you mentioned devolution there, and recently there has been moves for West Yorkshire devolution with a 1.8 billion devolution deal, including an elected mayor for West Yorkshire. Yes. What do you think is the significance of West Yorkshire having its own elected mayor?
Well, I think the first thing is that it's good that it's West Yorkshire rather than the Leeds City region. It sounds an arcane debate, but there was a little bit of a debate over the last two or three weeks in the county about what it should be called. And I think West Yorkshire is more inclusive than the Leeds City region would have been. It is a big figure, though I think that's over 30 years. So you're looking at about 40 million a year, but that's welcome. Fairly small in the scale of all the cuts that have happened over the last 10 years, but it is welcome. And it will mean there'll be a champion for the region, initially having powers over transport and skills, as well as the amount of money that we've both been discussing, and potentially over policing and crime and disorder and so on in a few years' time. So it's a significant step. I preferred, as did many council leaders in Yorkshire from both parties, having an arrangement for Yorkshire as a whole, and having a one Yorkshire mayor and cabinet of council leaders. The government always resisted that, and I think when they won a big majority of the election, I was at my count, the leader of Bradford was there, and as we were waiting for the results, and I thought I was going to lose, I said to her, well, you'll have to do a deal now, won't you, really, on the West Yorkshire basis. And so that's what's has been done because it had to be done. But I'd hope, and there is some provision in the small print of the deal, that there will be, well, there is already a one Yorkshire board of mayors in the county and leaders of the council, and the government's putting in a bit of money so that some things can be done at a one Yorkshire level, hopefully with the mayors of South Yorkshire and West Yorkshire, and potentially, if there are deals done in East Yorkshire and Hull and North Yorkshire, that they can all at least cooperate on some things. And I think many people in the county would like, under a future government, to see a one Yorkshire arrangement, because that really is the brand, if you like, the identity that people feel the strongest.
Why do you think there is growing support for devolution? Because if you go back to 2004, there was, of course, the North East England devolution referendum, which rejected an elected assembly for the region. Why do you think there's been a change?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think one of the problems, and I was involved in that campaign, and we never had a referendum in Yorkshire because that was going to be next. One of the problems was there was really no powers of any note at all being devolved to the Northeast, and people felt, well, why are we going to have another layer of government when it's not going to do anything? And I think John Prescott was a big advocate of it in the Labour government, the Deputy Prime Minister at the time, and he was sort of humoured a little bit with it, but he never really felt that Tony Blair's heart was particularly in it, or indeed many of the other members of the cabinet. Now, of course, since then, we've had devolution bedded in and established and grown, not just in the nations, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, over the intervening decade and more, but also in London and Manchester and so on, with and the West Midlands, with more substantial powers. And so I think you can see the example now of Sadiq Khan, shall we say, or Andy Burnham in Manchester, and people throughout the country, including in the North, can see the value of having a politician who everyone knows the name of, you know, and Ben Hutchin in the Tory in the Tees Valley as well. Another example of how local mayors can be better known than many MPs, and obviously that causes a bit of jealousy with some of the local MPs. But I think people have come around to the idea, well, you know, if they've got one in Manchester and Sadiq Khan in London and so on, we're missing out. And so I think that's probably led to a change of heart as well.
How much do you think that the support for devolution has been a pushback against people feeling left behind by globalisation? Because that's a remark that some people have made in relation to that. How true do you think that is?
No, I think that it has a lot of force and strength to it. And obviously the campaign regarding the referendum was take back control and so on and things. And so that chimes with that sentiment in society. And if you look around Europe and wider as a whole, cities, in my lifetime, I'm 59, and at one time I worked a long while ago now, 25 years ago or whatever, worked in Leeds, and about that time for the city council, it was the start of the, if you like, the revival of the great cities of particularly England outside London, Birmingham, Liverpool, Manchester and so on, were reviving in confidence, and people felt an affinity with them. I think it's true also of the county of Yorkshire, because it really is an important part of people's identity, really. Many people feel a part of Leeds or a part of Yorkshire as strongly as they feel English or British. And if decisions can be made at that level, I think people feel more in control. And also, I think you get better decisions, really. You know, why should you be deciding about whether a particular road should go ahead in Yorkshire and have to sign it off in Whitehall? It doesn't really make sense if it's a road of regional rather than national significance.
Now, I just wanted to turn to your time as a Member of Parliament.
Yes.
And I just wondered, you've served under three different parliamentary leaders of the Labour Party, Tony Blair, Gordon Brown and Jeremy Corbyn. I wondered what sort of differences you felt were apparent in the way that they led the parliamentary Labour Party.
Well, in the early days, because I was elected in 1997, and so you have these two giant figures on the left of British politics, Blair and Brown, who'd won an election by big majority. And really, they didn't have to have a great deal to do with any new backbenchers like myself. You know, they wouldn't be in the tea rooms very much or whatever, because there was a big majority there. And I suppose they felt that they'd got elected on a new Labour programme and you know, they were going to guide it. And in fact, many ministers, junior ministers, I think had less influence than special advisers, you know, and obviously that might have some resonance with today's Conservative administration in a big majority. And so I was always very proud to be a Labour MP, and I'm proud of the achievements we had. I actually fell into a role. I voted against the Iraq war and so on and things. And then I got involved in various other rebellions because I thought it was important that when we had a big majority, there had to be some challenge, really, to various policies. And I found a role in there. So it was a very, certainly until the end of the Brown administration, when it began to loosen up and begin to become slightly more disorganized, if you like, power was very centralized under the the height of Blair's power and the height of Brown's power, and you could get access to the Prime Minister and the Chancellor of the Exchequer. But over the Selby coalfield closures, for example, I made some gains there. But to really have influence, occasionally, I think you had to stand up to the machine because it was a very powerful machine. In the case of Jeremy Corbyn, again, you had a very there were no real better at involving backbenchers. I don't think Jeremy wasn't. Obviously, probably for different reasons. I wasn't there in the very unpleasant period in 2016. So I came in 2017. Obviously, the office around Jeremy were suspicious of many Labour MPs, if we're honest, and didn't really engage enough. I think probably Jeremy's big mistake, if there was one, was it's good, however you are as a leader, and to some extent Tony Blair appointed some people like John Cruddas, I remember, they're very different to him, but you've got to appoint people to your staff who think differently to you and are going to challenge you. And it was always a little bit of a bunker, I thought, with Jeremy, that it was people who he felt comfortable with over many decades, and we're not really going to challenge him, and we're not going to try and engage the Parliamentary Labour Party very much.
Now, you mentioned there some of the tensions that were in the Parliamentary Labour Party. Mm. I wonder, how do you feel that the public perception of MPs have changed since when you were first elected in 1997 to then returning for Keith Lee in 2017?
Yeah, well, I think there's always a healthy scepticism about members of Parliament and power on the part of the public. And, you know, that's gone back centuries when the Houses of Parliament burned down in, I think, the 1840s. The populace on the other side of the Thames cheered. And so to some extent, that scepticism has always been there. I think, obviously, the expenses scandal was a terrible time in 2009, 2010, and that broke the trust that many people at least had with their own individual MP. I think, you know, many people were a bit sceptical about politics in general, but they had, in some cases, they had strong bonds with their local MP. Even that was threatened in 2010. And then, obviously, the growth of social media has completely changed the dynamic, really. When I was first an MP, I used to take home a big box of letters every week, and that's only 20 years ago. You know, when I was the MP for Keighley, I'd barely get two or three letters a week, and it was all emails and social media, and so much more immediate. But you've got to be robust as a member of Parliament. In most cases, I think people are reasonable. There obviously some terrible cases when there haven't been. And it can be tough sometimes, but there is a need to have a thick skin, I guess.
I just wonder, how do you think that new MPs coming in under the recent election in the Conservative government will be feeling about the role, given that in certain seats, particularly in the North, they won't have had a Conservative MP before? Do you think that there's going to be a sort of a tension there in how they represent their constituents, or what?
Well, I mean, there's some good ones. I've in the new intake on both sides, but I've met some and listened to some Conservatives who will be formidable representatives. I think they'll be all very keen and eager. I can remember when I was first in, and I hope I kept some of that keenness down the years. And I think they'll be anxious to get bedded in their constituencies and go around and get to know people. I mean, I think one political dynamic which will be interesting now is obviously on the government's desk is whether they reduce the number of constituencies, because there's an outstanding Boundary Commission report which would reduce the number of constituencies by 50. And the Conservatives initiated this because they thought it was being their interest. Now, in the north of England, many of their new MPs would be affected by this. So, at the time, they're wanting to become Mr. or Ms. Local and really get a good, strong identity with their local constituency. Many of them won't want to be losing or changing those boundaries. So I think that would be interesting in the next year or two to see whether the government pursues that boundary change or whether it amends it and maybe keeps the same number of seats. But it will be, for some, it will be a bit of a culture clash. There'll be some MPs who didn't expect to be there. And I can remember when Labour got in 1997, I think Peter Mandelson, who was one of Tony Blair's right-hand men at the time, famously remarked after election day, "Who are all these people?" Because he got lots of MPs like me who he didn't expect to have. So I suspect there was a number 10 Downing Street the Friday after the election. There was a hurried look at who some of these new Tories were.
Now, at the beginning of the podcast, I mentioned that you're the chair of the Mongolian British Chamber of Commerce.
Yes.
I wondered if you could just explain your interest and your connection to Mongolia.
Yeah. Well, firstly, Mongolia is a proud democracy, I'll have you know, in between China and Russia. And it exported Kashmir, or still does, to Yorkshire. And when I said I worked for Lee City Council, and the Lord Mayor went there in the 90s because Burton's Clothing, which was a big Leeds clothing group at the time, the patriarch of that group had gone out to Mongolia just the once and fell in love with it. So I knew a bit about Mongolia when I went to Parliament, and it's half the size of Western Europe, 3 million people, and so I got involved in the all-party group for Mongolia. There's lots of groups in Parliament of different interest groups bringing MPs from all parties together. Now, there was obviously lots of people might want to be the chair of the all-party United States group or the China group, but there's not much competition for the all-party Mongolia group. And when I retired in Parliament in 2010 for the first time, I got a bit of a business background, so the ambassador asked me to set up a Chamber of Commerce. So I've done that, and since I lost in December, I've revived it, and so we encourage economic links between the United Kingdom and Mongolia. There's all sorts of people over there, including Cambridge University and different architects and lawyers and all sorts of people. And our main promotional activity is a burn supper in minus 40 in January. So there we are. So it'll keep me occupied, I think.
We're coming towards the end of the podcast. It's been great to speak to you, John. And I'd just like to ask you one final question. Now, I know, and I say this as a Yorkshireman myself, I say you are very much proud of being from Yorkshire.
Yes.
And I just wondered, finally, what would you say is the one thing that makes you proudest to be from Yorkshire?
Well, I suppose it's a cliche, but the people and the range, actually, of people from the industry to the coast, to the great cities and so on. And I think that's what Yorkshire has to offer. Some people say that devolution should just be about cities, but I think if we could get Yorkshire together as a whole, we would offer, well, it's as big as Scotland in terms of population. And so with that range, I think, could give us a place, not just on the national, but on the international stage. And I hope to live to see it.
Well, I think that's a sentiment I certainly agree with, and one I think a lot of our listeners will agree with as well. Thank you once again for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. Don't forget that you can subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Podbean, or YouTube. You can follow us at Debated Podcast on Twitter. Like us, Debated Podcast on Facebook. And if you want to email us, either about appearing or making a comment or reaction to the episode you've heard or any other episodes, then email us thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next